Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is the Wheel of Time.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellows, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here, as always. And with us back today from the original podcast team is Jason.
Thank you, Virginia. It's very, very great to be back. It really is. I want to thank everyone that's kept the podcast going for so long in my absence. Andrew, Virginia, Amir, Jesse, the on-air personalities have been fantastic. I have been keeping up with it. Our editors, of course, Spencer, David, Laura, and everybody else that's even contributed even a little bit to this podcast. It really, really does make me proud. Just a really quick explanation of where I've been is my brother, my little brother, had an AVM, which is an arterious ventricle malformation. I think that's how to say it. I say AVM. But he had an AVM rupture in his brain. And I've been dealing with that, so that's where I've been for the past few months. AVMsurvivors.org is the website if you want to give any money, if you just want to learn about it. A couple of the Dragonmount, the people that run Dragonmount, have expressed their support for me, and I appreciate that more than anything. So I really do appreciate all the support I've gotten from everyone.
This week in the podcast, we will be continuing our multiple-part series, which will be recapping Knife of Dreams in an effort to get through the book before The Gathering Storm comes out.
What is with all this racket?
It's a spoiler warning, my lord. Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series that is vast and quite large, and there may be listeners that have not yet completed the series.
Are you saying that I have...
Of course not! My lord is wise and all-knowing. But if there were people listening that have not yet finished the Wheel of Time series, they would be advised to stop now or risk the chance of spoiling parts of the series they have not read.
Ah, I see. Well, do remember, I have a bit of business to take care of on the other side of...
Of course! My lord will do as he must. I will stand guard.
We're going to start with Chapter 1, and we'll see how far we get. So Virginia is going to start us off with a summary of Chapter 1.
Okay, well, we start off with Chapter 1. The title of the chapter is When Last Sounds, and we begin with Swan Sanchez's point of view. She's in Saladar, and the Aes Sedai there have recently learned that Egwene's boat was found capsized on the shore of the Erinnyin, and they all assume that she is dead. Her maid, Chesa, is weeping inconsolably. Swan eventually manages to go to Gareth's tent and fall asleep, and she finds that Egwene is waiting for her to tell her the news that she is indeed not dead, and summons her to meet with her in Teleronriad. So Swan wakes up, gets the Twisted Ring, and then joins her in Teleronriad, where she, Egwene, reports on her and Lyanna's situation and gives her orders that there is to be no rescue. She wakes up, and with her orders in mind, she borrows a horse, Night Lily, and rides like a crazy woman to the Aes Sedai camp. And after her little adventure of riding, which we know that Swan is a notoriously bad rider, she arrives at camp. She finds that Sheriam, Morvryn, and Morel are all in the tent, in Morel's tent, and they are discussing what to do. Carlinia and Sheriam are also in there. She reports what Egwene has told her about she and Lyanna being alive and well, and that they mostly succeeded with turning the harbor chains to Quendiar. Baon was not with the group and did not join them, and they supposedly have sent for Nissau, but she did not show up either. Sheriam and Morel immediately want to travel to free Egwene, but Egwene has ordered no rescue to be even attempted because she doesn't want any more Aes Sedai to be in danger of being killed. They're all confused because they don't understand why Elida did not order an immediate trial, and Sheriam is still very angry because Elida has abolished the Bu'aja. And then Lelaine enters. They tell her about Egwene, and then, for some strange reason, she asks Swan to walk outside with her. Elaine, but at this point in time, basically tells Siwan that she's uncovered Faolin's spying and has been keeping her confined and questioning her. Apparently, Faolin didn't reveal too much, but enough that Elaine has put together a lot of clues. Siwan then tells Elaine that Egwene has ordered a sitting of the hall in the White Tower, and in Teleron Riadh, in the hall of the tower, when last sounds the next night, which Elaine laughs out loud. She thinks that's just so funny that this is happening right under Elida's nose. She keeps the betrayal, Siwan keeps the betrayal of Egwene a secret because she believes that someone in the hall was the leak. Elaine then leans on Siwan to tell her that she needs her support for the Amelin seat against Romanda if Egwene dies or is stilled, and Siwan now worries that if Elaine did not have a reason before to betray Egwene, she does now. So, what springs to mind to you fellows from all of that?
Well, the first thing that occurred to me picked up the book and the first time I read it was the wind starting from the peak of Dragonmount. You know, and it, to me, in my mind, I went, okay, the final stretch to Tarmogn Gaidin has just happened. We started the series with Dragonmount being created in a prologue. And, you know, now we've got the wind, this infamous wind that we always see in the very beginning, rising from Dragonmount itself. And that just was amazingly cool in my mind.
And that's really funny because I left that completely out of the summary because I didn't think of it as being too important. Oh, I apologize. But you're right. It is.
That's all right.
No, it is indicative, I think. You're right, of the last battle approaching more and more closely. I think the one thing that struck me right off the bat, and it really is probably, and I'll get the levity out of the way in the beginning, but it's actually one of my pet peeves in the books, and that is, how in the world is Siwan Sanche still such a dreadful writer after all this time? I mean, it just boggles my mind the amount of difficulty that she has on horseback.
Well, I actually kind of had a thought about that, too. During all that time, while Siwan is, you know, fussing with the horse, both before and during, and, you know, as she's getting down from it, she keeps, like, complaining about how, you know, horses have brains and they might decide to do anything, and I don't see how anybody can possibly bear to ride a horse. You know, boats are so much simpler, and they, you know, anybody with half a mind can use a boat, and the boat will always go where you tell it. And it seems to me that the characters who are really, really good with horses are the exact opposite and complain about boats and how, you know, you have to be a genius to be able to sail a boat. And it kind of seemed, you know, just boggling in my mind that it's like, okay, people, it's just a different means of conveyance. Seriously. You know, how hard can it be for you to just pick up a little bit extra skill?
I know, that's my real problem because, you know Moraine in the White Tower when they were both accepted and they go riding off to look for the, you know, women and everything in New Spring that had possibly birthed the Dragon Reborn. You know she was giving her lessons in how to ride. I just can't believe somebody that's so talented in every other respect. I don't expect her to be able to ride dressage, but I mean, in that day and age, somebody who just can't get on a horse and go from place A to B without all this, you know, nonsense is just beyond it. And I'll tell you, the other person that really freaks me out about the same issue is Avienda. Because it just seems so odd to me that somebody with the amount of physical skill to become a Maiden of the Spear and be a good one shouldn't have any trouble picking up another little skill like riding a horse. It's just not that hard. But then I speak as a person who can ride a horse and couldn't throw a spear to save my life, so maybe there's justice there.
Just personally, you know, when I read the books, I think part of what the whole difficulty in riding a horse thing is part of what her character is. Because, I mean, yes, she has difficulty riding a horse, which should seem so simple. But also she has so much difficulty, admitting and submitting to her feelings for Gareth Byrne. And I kind of feel like the two of those things very, very much parallel each other. Not only for her, too, but you said Avienda. It's almost like a coming to peace with who you are thing where many, many of the characters have not only one, but two and three different things that they very, very much rebel against. And it's kind of a character development thing where, you know, once she learns to submit to riding a horse, you know, maybe that's the time when she submits to being a absolutely in love with Gareth Bryan.
Well, that's a pretty good point, actually, and something else just occurred to me, that some of these little character flaws may be a literary device in a way that Robert Jordan was trying to keep some of his more powerful and strong-willed and strong-natured characters from becoming too powerful. And that's always an issue when you have a fantasy series with magic users in particular. It's just really easy to create somebody who's so powerful that they can't really be defeated. You have to give them flaws and weaknesses. So, anyway, that's my little rant, and I'm sorry I sort of threw that in there on you, but anyway. I guess the first thing that picked up in my mind that I picked up was Sheriam's reaction to the news that Egwene and Lyanna were alive. She was just alight, you know, with the anxiety and anxiousness to go. And I don't know why she was so especially eager to rescue Egwene. I mean, did she know somehow anything about Halima and Delana's plans, or was she just under orders from whoever was doing the beating of her? Because I really feel that somebody, either a Dark Friend or one of the Forsaken, has been the one who's been trying to get information from her, either trying to beat it out of her or beating her for not getting it, one of the two. And then again, my other pet theory that Sheriam might possibly be one of the characters who's been turned by the combination of 13 Dreadlords or Black Aja channeling through 13 Murdral, because, as we know, we haven't seen that yet, and I think it's too good a plot device not to have.
Yeah, I know. I was kind of struck, and I mean, Simone even thinks in her point of view about the fact that it's really surprising at how flighty Sheriam's become. That, I mean, she flitters back and forth. She's not showing barely any of the decorum that comes with being a keeper. And, you know, kind of just one of those weird things on how, like, she just seems to kind of be devolving as a person under the pressure of everything that's going on around her.
Yeah, she's really acting very much out of character in the last book or two especially. And I fear that that is, you know, because of the influence of whoever's trying to use her, basically. It's got to be either a Darkfriend or one of the Forsaken. I can't imagine, you know, who else would have the ability to overcome her in that fashion. She is Aes Sedai, and not weak in the power, I believe. What do you think, Jason? Have any thoughts on that?
I confess I do not.
Oh my gosh. I guess another thing that struck me was on page 111 of the paperback, which is when Baonin is just woken up in the morning and she's going to the traveling grounds, she notices the sisters, you know, going to the negotiations. Why are they still doing that? I mean, especially if they know that Egwene has been captured, why are they even bothering? Are they just going to say, well, we're not going to show up anymore? Or you think they'd just not show up?
I think that they would be expecting to receive new terms. Obviously, there's going to be a point in time where the Tower Aes Sedai are going to let the rebel camp believe that Egwene and Lan are dead, but eventually it's going to have to come out that they're alive. And I imagine that since most of the people who are going to be dealing with the negotiations are probably going to be Greys, they would go to the negotiations in expecting that they're going to now be receiving terms, and they're going to try to, you know, do counter-argument and back and forth like they are wont to do.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. We haven't heard anything from Elida one way or the other, I believe in the whole book, about any terms that she would accept on, you know, releasing so on. She basically just intends to keep her, I think. Anyway, on the same page, page 111 of the U.S. paperback, the Aes Sedai Morvran thinks that and mentions to the others that if Egwene is not to be tried and stilled, then they must be planning to break her. And I was wondering, with all that we've heard on this subject before, how can they do that when they are apparently forbidden to torture or, you know, threaten torture or harm an initiate of the Tower? They can't use the One Power on her either.
Is there a possibility that they can hold through enough charges or you know, infractions against Egwene for her actions that they could still get away with questioning or torturing her under the guise that, oh, well, we're just disciplining one of our initiates for not following within the rules.
Well, I don't know. I think even birching is pretty severe, but they don't seem to have any problem doing that to each other. I guess, you know, maybe it's just another case of, you know, the rules are whatever Aes Sedai say the rules are.
Well, and general questioning, which can be pretty rough, you know, there are specific rules for that. I mean, Varin goes through an entire thing in one of her point of views in the series about how, you know, if it, or it might not be Varin, it might be Vandine and Aedlis before the entire mess with them happens, where they, you know, it has to be begun, or once it's begun by, like, sunrise, it has to finish by sunset, and there's, like, weird rules that govern, you know, the questioning of someone.
Yeah, they have to offer healing, you know, before and after, or whatever. Yeah, it was when they were traveling to Camelin, and they were questioning, was it Phelan? No. She had a similar name. One of the Black Aja that they captured, you know, after Ebedar. Okay, anyway, I just thought that was kind of odd. I don't know how they were expecting to be able to break her if they can't use physical punishment on her. I suppose they could use sleep deprivation or something like that, but apparently they think that mortification of the spirit by just demoting her to accept it is enough. But the other thing that kind of struck me, and this is probably nothing because it's not an exact simile, but Morgan also is described as tapping her chin with one of her fingers, and that, for some reason, just strongly reminded me of Masana, who had the habit of tapping her lips with her finger. And I just wondered, you know, could that be one of the disguises that Masana is wearing? We know she's disguised as a sister in the White Tower, and there's no reason not to believe, and I think she even alluded to the fact that she was also involved in the Rebel Aes Sedai camp, and I just wondered, you know, maybe she's, you know, disguising herself as Morvern. I don't know. What do you think?
Honestly, it does sound like something that Masana would do. At the same time, I can also see it being one of those things that RJ would throw in there purposefully to throw people off. You know, just one of those little, you know, I'm going to do something that is just similar enough that you're going to be completely convinced that Masana's right over here, when actually in, you know, some later plot line you'll find out she was actually someplace else doing something different.
Yeah, he was really good at those little red herrings. Okay, next point.
Does a red herring taste different than other herrings?
I've never had one. I wouldn't know. Bring me red herring and I'll tell you, or else just bring me pizza. I would like to know, maybe you can shed some insight on this, why do you think Lelaine is now suddenly cozying up to Sawan? I mean, she doesn't know about Egwene being gone. Why now? Or does she? Why was she holding and questioning Phelan? And why does Lelaine still hold on to the notion that Phelan isn't really Aes Sedai? I don't understand that. But I really don't understand that sudden, out of the blue, coincidentally, on the very day that we find out that Egwene, too coincidental to be believed.
Her feelings about Phelan and her status as an Aes Sedai. I kind of get the idea that a number of them, Lelaine, and that Egwene raised, accepted up to Aes Sedai status without them ever having taken the test or holding the oath rod, as kind of like one of those, okay, our quote-unquote a Merlin said that it's so we're going to play along until they can get back into the tower. And it's one of those things that now that Egwene is not about, they feel that they can kind of be freer about expressing, oh, well, she's not really Aes Sedai. We just said that because, you know, the person we had as a Merlin was insistent upon it. And, you know, we're going to do whatever we want until, you know, we get Egwene back or she's dead or stilled.
Yeah, but she had snapped up Phelan and kept her confined for about a week before Egwene disappeared. You know, we just found out that she had, you know, kept her confined and been questioning her on the day that, actually the next morning almost, after Egwene had been captured by the Tower Aes Sedai.
True. I mean, like I said, I think that basically stems to their feelings initially, even from the moment that Egwene said, oh, these people are raised to Aes Sedai. The ones who weren't going to accept it immediately went, well, that's a joke, but since we can't openly say that it's a joke, you know, we'll just treat them as if they were, you know, an Aes Sedai who is so new and so far below us in the one power that essentially they still are accepted in our eyes.
I suppose. I actually thought that was kind of a bad idea when Egwene came up with it, too. That would have probably offended me had I been Aes Sedai. And, you know, that test for accepted is so awful that no one is even going to, you know, think about putting them through that. You know, we have to presume that the test for Aes Sedai was just as bad. The only one we saw was Moraine in New Spring. But I had to laugh that the Mistress of Novices said that, you know, when Egwene was basically, quote-unquote, busted down to novice again, she said, well, I wouldn't put you through the test again for accepted, you know, but still, you know, you're not really Aes Sedai or the Amelin.
Yeah, I as to the overture, I think a lot of people, and this may be stretching things a little bit, somehow believe that Siwan is kind of puppet mastering. She doesn't have the strength or the credentials to be a Merlin anymore. And I think she kind of, a number of people figure that Egwene is the figurehead whose strings are kind of pulled by the ruling council, you know, chunk of the hall that originally was making all the decisions. And then those people seem to be siding with or taking some hidden suggestion from Siwan. So I think they kind of see this weird sort of trickle-down effect where it ends up being that Siwan is kind of still acting as a Merlin through all these other people by proxy. Or if she's not controlling it, she's at least intimately connected with the people who are assumed to actually be controlling things. And that might be where the overture comes from, is because if you can get in with Siwan, especially now that she's so much weaker in the power than she was, then you have yourself a tie to the people who were, quote-unquote, actually making the decisions, not knowing the fact that it actually was Egwene making the decisions.
That's true, and Elaine and Siwan are both Blue Aja, so that's, you know, already a link between them, whereas I think Romanda would have had to do a lot more work to try and ingratiate herself with Siwan.
Well, if she could be bothered to do so.
Yeah, exactly. The two of those people, Romanda and Elaine, are so arrogant. It's just amazing to me that anybody would tolerate that. Okay, well, this is my last thought, unless you guys have any other suggestions. And this is kind of a minor little thing, but I just wonder why it is that they're all so convinced that a rescue attempt for Egwene would result in the deaths of sisters. I mean, surely they can just open gateways and travel there and take somebody by surprise and snatch her up and be gone before anything could happen, shield the people, you know, tie them up with air. I mean, even an Aes Sedai who's surprised can be, you know, cut off from the source and shielded and wrapped in air. It just doesn't seem beyond the bounds of possibility, particularly when, well, I don't know how many of the people Egwene has taught, but she certainly taught some of them to invert their weaves and disguise themselves with illusion. It just doesn't seem like it's beyond the bounds of possibility, unless Egwene just really wants to stay there to work from within.
Well, I mean, part of it is that you'd actually have to know precisely where you're going to be, you know, where you're going when you're traveling, and the slightest mishap, you know, if you gateway into a hallway, even in deep cells, well, you know, what happens if the sisters who happen to be guarding Leanne and they're assuming Egwene, you happen to be looking in that direction? Number one, you know, yes, you might overpower them in the time it takes for them to be, you know, shocked at what the heck, you know, but at the same time, there's a good chance those women are going to learn how that weave is done, you know, by seeing the gateway. You know, there's always the residuals And, you know, if even one person happens to not be stunned enough and manages to put up a fight, you know, any battle with the One Power is going to turn deadly in half an instant. And by and large, if they've got any amount of warders, well, you know, the warders are going to rush in regardless of the fact that Aes Sedai are channeling, and it's just going to be murder and chaos all over the place.
Well, I have to agree with you in part, and another part of me disagrees, because I do distinctly remember Egwene thinking to herself in her point of view after Meragyn, a.k.a. Mogideon, escaped, that now she could go ahead and teach the weaves for disguising oneself and inverting the flow so that the ability to channel could not be detected. I mean, what's to prevent them from, you know, popping into a secluded place like Baon did in the woods, which they all know, you know, somewhere near the Ogier steading, or any, you know, out-of-the-way little place where there's not likely to be anybody, you know, put the weaves of illusion on themselves just like Baon did, walk into the White Tower, figure out where the heck Egwene is, figure out where the heck Lelaine is, and then, you know, I mean, if somebody that you think you know walks up next to you, like somebody that you might be expecting to relieve you from guard duty or something like that, you're not going to be expecting them to just throw a shield on you and tie you up with air, so there's no need for them to see a gateway. There's no need for a big fight. I mean, I just figure there just has to be some way.
I think it would be easier if they were able to disguise themselves as people they would know would be in the tower, but would know wouldn't necessarily be down in the cells guarding. You know, like, if you, you know, the Mistress of Novices isn't going to be down guarding someone in the cells. She's got other and more important things to be doing, so, you know, if you can weave the illusion. Now, the only problem there is that if you don't have someone who is nearly the same size, shape as Sylveana, then you've got problems because, well, the weave doesn't work as well.
Well, I think the weave works as well. It's just easier to maintain a weave that is, you know, closer in form to what, you know, what they have. But, I mean, they could even disguise themselves as an accepted that they know is in the tower. Accepted gets sent on errands or novices all the time. You know, they could be sent down there, I have a message from, you know, somebody to somebody else. I mean, they could get away with a lot, just with a little bit of forethought and planning. I mean, for one thing, less than a third of the sisters that are normally in the tower are still in the tower. We remember that, I believe it was Elaine, reflects on the fact that a third of the sisters were in Saladar, a third of the sisters were in the White Tower, and a third of them were out and about doing their thing and haven't come down publicly on one side or the other. They're just out there running around. So the tower is basically as empty as it's ever going to get. And, you know, they don't have the hordes and hordes of novices floating around that they do in Saladar or the rebel camp and everything. I mean, they have more, but nothing like, I mean, it seems to me that it would be really easy to mount a decent, you know, they could even bring the warders and some of the, you know, people like Gareth Bryn and stuff like that with them. They could disguise them with illusion. You can put an illusion on somebody else. You remember Elaine slapped an illusion on Nynaeve and made her look like a seafolk woman without a blouse, you know, and Elaine was drunk at the time. Okay, I'm done with chapter one then. I have nothing. Lead us on into chapter two, Andrew.
Chapter 2 begins with Bayonin's point of view. Moirvrin has woken Bayonin in the middle of the night to tell her that Egwene is still alive. It really, you know, Bayonin has problems expressing the enthusiasm at having woken up. We can tell she has already made some sort of decision, which on some level is making her warder ill at ease. She sends him to fetch horses, and they are going to go to the traveling grounds. While he is away getting the horses, Bayonin is approached by Ashvanael and Phaedryn. They are very ecstatic that Egwene and Lyanna are alive and well, though still a bit ill at ease about the fact that Lyanna has been healed from stilling. But they have sought out Bayonin, despite her desire for privacy this particular morning, because they are investigating the murders of Anya and Carrion, who were killed with Siding in the camp. Bannon tells them that both had had contact with Moraine de Modred and Rand Al'Thor, and suggests that they should continue to follow those connections, while stating that it probably was not Rand who committed the murders. Rand has gathered together a great number of Ashaman. She eventually leaves them with the advice to continue following the connections in order to determine who has killed the two sisters in the camp. She then travels with her warder to the traveling ground, and from there they travel into Tarvalon. Once there, she puts on an illusion to disguise herself. She sends her warder, Tervail, to find an inn within the city and wait while she enters the White Tower, having masked her ability to channel. The point of view then shifts to Elaida, who is in her study with King Maten Stapanios of Ilion. She is trying to placate him with her rather frail temper over the issue of him having been kidnapped. She pretty much goads him by saying, well, you know, Rand Al'Thor took Ilion away from you, or from your control, sheer hours after you left, and you should be grateful to the White Tower. She eventually sends him off to freshen himself and to be escorted to his rooms, and asks for Tarna to come in. As Elaida is going through the vast myriad of problems, including the backed-up sewers and the mounting garbage problem in Tarvalon with Tarna, they are interrupted by Fe'alana and Nagain, who have brought a woman petitioner into the White Tower for Elaida to meet. This petitioner actually turns out to be Bannon in disguise. Once the other sisters have left, she comes in to explain her work as Elida's mole in the Saladar Aes Sedai camp. She commends Elaida for keeping Egwene alive and untried, stating that, number one, she has discovered a great number of new weaves, and that she is more talented even so than Elaine and Nynaeve for discovering new weaves. She says that Lelaine and Ramonda are still struggling for power, and that she thinks it is possible that now with Elaine gone and Lelaine and Ramonda struggling, that soon a number of sisters will follow Bannon's example and return to the White Tower of their own accord. She does also mention to Elaida that that Egwene is indeed a dreamer. She is able to enter Teleron Riad in her sleep, though other Aes Sedai do need dream Tarangriel, which are plentiful amidst the rebel camp, and that they know a lot of what's going on in the White Tower because of their various trips into Teleron Riad. This, of course, stuns Elaida terribly, because Teleron Riad is almost mythical to Aes Sedai as they currently stand in the world. Tarna worries about Egwene's warning, as it has now been confirmed that she is indeed a dreamer, about the Shanshan attack, but Elaida sort of dismisses it because, you know, how more prepared can you be with the Shanshan sitting where they are, barely even touching Ilion yet. Elaida is fairly confident that Sylveana will break Egwene and that they will be able to extract as much information as they need from her. Bannon confesses she can't make Quendiar, but she is good at the new form of healing that Nynaeve discovered. She demonstrates traveling and skimming for Elaida and Tarna, and Elaida extorts an order from her that she is not to teach any sisters the weaves that she has learned without Elida's expressed permission. Bannon then tells her about the 10 moles that have been sent to the tower to spread dissension through the rumors of the Red Aja and Loghain, including Meidani, whom Elaida asks Tarna to have watched and to have Mayadani sent to her for dinner that particular evening. When Tarna leaves to execute those particular commands of Elida's, Elida then orders Bayonin to teach her everything that she has learned. There really wasn't a great deal that I found in this chapter that was on a less overt level. I mean, most of the things that seemed to happen in this level, in this chapter, seemed to be really upfront and open. I can't even think of how to explain it. One of the things that really kind of stuck with me is just the entire scene between Elida and King Mauten, because they were just, I mean, he is absolutely furious, and he's huffing and, you know, you can't do this to me anymore, the White Tower can't do this, you know, they have no right to do this, they don't have the authority to do this anymore, and, you know, Elida has all these things, including her grandiose clock that, you know, has the Amyrlin being knelt to by the king and the queen, and she has her chair with the flame of Tarvalon and moonstones directly above her head, and, you know, she's trying so hard to just force the image of her being a powerful Amyrlin down people's throats, and, you know, it screams like even part of her point of view was, oh, I have to get an enameler in here to have the blue Aja stripe removed from the clocks, from the Amyrlin stole on the clock. But, you know, there are so many important things that need to be done first. But it still pops into her mind. And, you know, at this point, there's so much going on, including, you know, the ghosts that have been appearing, which are scaring people and keeping them from cleaning the streets so that the garbage isn't being taken out. You know, a ghost even appears to Bayonin as she, you know, when she first arrives in the White Tower, you know, or in the grove outside of the White Tower, she sees the ghost of Turain, Murdagan, who died like 40 years ago, and, It's just kind of amazing that with all this stuff going on that she's not, okay, things are bad, it's crunch time, let's get down to it. She's so less businesslike about the business of being a Merlin than Egwene was that it kind of literally astounds me.
The thing that I take away from the chapter the most, just looking back and remembering it, is Elida's arrogance. Not that she hadn't shown her arrogance before this chapter, but this is really like, you know, it's gotten to a breaking point of arrogance. Oh, to me, anyway.
No, I agree. That's been one of my feelings about Elida, is that she is so arrogant, stubborn, and possibly stupid that it really doesn't matter if she's a Dark Friend or not. She's basically accomplishing everything that a Dark Friend would. I don't know how much of that was her native character and how much of that was enhanced by her contact with Padon Fain several books ago, who says in his own point of view that he brushed her with a taint, and that she and Pedron the Isle, who is now dead, but he brushed her with enough of his taint that she would never trust Althor, ever. Not that I don't think she ever really would, but she's the absolute opposite of a good leader. I mean, she comes down hard on people for all the wrong things, she worries about all the wrong things, and she just basically lets her arrogance run her. And it's really sad that the Aes Sedai, the Hall of the Tower, and everything haven't already risen up and deposed her of their own accord. It's just beyond. I guess they're so busy, you know, sniping at one another that they don't even care that most of their troubles are stemming from Elida.
Another thing that really stuck out in this chapter to me, there is a point where Elida is thinking of how she's read every prophecy and foretelling dating back, you know, even to the breaking, that concern the days coming up to the last battle. And somewhere in that particular section, she thinks to herself, and it's after they mention that the people are being frightened by seeing the dead walking and, you know, not cleaning up the streets of Tarvalon, that she thinks, well, worse than the dead walking will happen before the last battle. And, you know, to me, yeah, the lot of really bad stuff is going on, but as signs and portents of the last battle coming goes, the dead walking is apparently supposed to be one of the first. And I am just, you know, thinking to myself, worse than the dead walking is going to happen yet? I mean, really? How much worse signs are we going to need at this point?
Yeah, well, of course, in a total spoiler alert here, but then we know that reality itself seems on the verge of unraveling later on in the book, so I think that's probably worse than the dead walking, certainly of more immediate concern. But all that Linus worried about are the sewers are clogged and there are rats in the White Tower. This should have been on top. This is important. Yeah, it's a symptom of everything else that's going wrong, dear. And she's sitting there thinking of the pleasurable news of the fact that Terramon is now rebelling against the Shanshan, and she just so doesn't have the big picture. Even though she studied all the foretellings and the prophecies and etc., she just doesn't get it. She just doesn't get it. She doesn't even reflect on the dissension among the Ajahs and the different sisters in the tower, and she reflects herself a couple of times in her point of view, and how is that supposed to be mended? But she let it happen. She was instrumental in making it happen under Alviarin's influence, of course, but I think she was well on the way to doing a lot of that herself. I don't know. I don't see her doing anything to try to bring the Ajahs back together, and she doesn't have Alviarin running her anymore. You know, she could just up and say, I want harmony to start being promoted between the Ajahs now. I mean, she doesn't have the ability to tell the Tall of the Tower what to do, but she can certainly influence them. She can certainly lay it in front of them and let people know that she thinks that they ought to get back to it. But she's not doing any of that. All she's worried about is folding Gareth Bryan's army into hers and making him captain of the Tower Guards, and he'll be so much better than Jimmar Trubane, blah, 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 blah. I mean, she just doesn't get it.
I did also catch a little bit in there when Bannon first comes in. She mentions to Elida, she's like, I noticed, you know, sisters staring at each other like strange cats. You know, what's been happening in the tower recently, Mother? And it's Tarna who actually kind of steps in and says, you know, well, there are certain factions that oppose Elida almost as much as the rebel camp itself, and, you know, just kind of basically spills the beans that, you know, oh, we're not all big happy sorority here anymore.
The thing that got me about that chapter is that Bannon knows that already. I mean, she went to all that trouble to disguise herself, weave illusion on herself, invert her weave so nobody could tell she was channeling, and she appeared in the White Tower as though she's just another commoner, petitioner, coming to lay a petition before the Amarylline seat. And she says to herself, and she says to Elida, she says, I disguised myself so that I could get here unbruised. But she knew before, right after she traveled there, before she ever entered the White Tower, she knew about the dissension in the tower. How did she know that if she's been sitting in Saladar and on the march and not had contact with Elida? I think that's really a symptom of something else. There's something else going on there. I'm not sure what.
Well, I mean, the thing is she knows that they had sent moles in to, you know, cause a certain amount of dissension. So maybe it's possible that she's just assuming that they did their job at least well enough that there's, you know, some fractioning amidst the various people, or the various Aes Sedai Ajahs and stuff.
That's true, but as the Ferrets, as Egwene calls them, were only sent to the White Tower to spread the rumor of the Reds having to do with false dragons and propping up Loghain and so forth and so on. All that was aimed specifically at the Red Aja, not all the others. So I don't think, unless Van has had lots of contact with somebody, or at least one good contact with somebody from the White Tower in between the time that she left before Saladar and now, that she would have any way to know that all of the Ajahs were at each other's throats. And she said, those Aes Sedai were not just staring at each other. She said they were glaring at each other. And, I mean, she picked that up just walking through the tower from the gates to Elida's study. Wow. It must be really bad. I just want to know how she knew. Clearly she's had some contact with somebody from the White Tower. Whether it's another Aes Sedai or it's a dark friend, I don't know. And why did she decide to decamp right now? Just because Egwene was captured? Was that the determining factor in causing her to go? Well, and then the other thing that I think about on this is that why in the world did Egwene let all these sisters and the rebel can't learn to travel. I think that was such a big mistake. She always knew that there was the possibility of Elida's supporters in the camp. She says in her point of view that she dismissed it, but I think she was a fool to do that, and Egwene is seldom a fool. I don't understand why she would have made such a big error.
Yeah, that seemed a little incongruous, but at the same time, I think Egwene probably did that sort of teaching in order that, I mean, sort of in the hopes that maybe if she did it, she could win even some of those people who were supporters of Elida to, you know, come over in reality. You know, the idea of teaching the Aes Sedai these weaves is more for the concept of improving all Aes Sedai. I mean, she I think it was pretty much one of those ideas that, you know, when once you're Aes Sedai, you get taught the Water Bond. Whether or not you ever actually use it, you are eventually taught the Water Bond. And it's like, honestly, traveling should be a weave that every Aes Sedai is taught, in theory. And I think Egwene was kind of trying to practice the theory without the foresight of its practical application.
Actually, I have to disagree with you about that. The Reds are not taught the Water Bond, at least according to the Aes Sedai that went to the Black Tower to bond some of the Taim's faction of Ashaman, because I can't remember her name now. One of the Aes Sedai that's with Pavara asks her, where did you learn the Water Bond? And she had gone to Yuriko, and asked her how, a roundabout way to teach her, to show her the Water Bond. She didn't know it, and she was one of the ones who thought that Red should bond warders. So I'm going to say that they're probably not routinely taught that, because the other Aes Sedai was surprised that she knew it.
That's right. The Water Bond, obviously, bad example, but I mean, there are certain weaves that pretty much hard and fast all Aes Sedai are taught. Certainly the rest of the Ajahs are taught the Water Bond.
Healing.
And it seems to me that the point, moreover, was that there are certain weaves that pretty much every Aes Sedai should know. And those are the kinds of things that I think Egwene considered that traveling and, you know, being able to disguise oneself might actually be useful and might improve Aes Sedai as a whole if they were to, if they were open to being taught to everybody.
I suppose, but I guess I'm just suspicious, but if it had been me trying to win back a war against the actual entrenched White Tower in her precarious position, I think I would have only taught that to my very, very closest friends and allies. I don't think I would have let that out to the general population until the White Tower was united. Yes, then let everybody know, but it's too big an advantage to give to the other side, and as we can see with Bannon, she just let it go. Now they know. It's only her dumb luck that Elida decided not to let everybody else learn it. She told Tarna she couldn't teach it to anybody else, but Beonin could teach it to Tarna, but nobody else could know. But, you know, once something like that's out, it's really out of the bag. I think the only other thing that really had in this that I had notes on was, this is kind of going backward just a little bit, but just before Naya and Kyren, why do you think she does that? Does she know who really killed her? Those two Sedai? I mean, why would she go to the trouble of trying to send them off? I mean, they didn't buy it. Even Veldor kind of goes, I don't think it's going to lead to the Ashaman, you know. That whole thing seemed odd to me. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think she handled it poorly. And I think part of that was just her, she was talking about how, you know, she had her hood up, and that was supposed to mean that, you know, she wanted privacy and people weren't supposed to come and talk to her. And, you know, she kind of seemed really annoyed and put out that these people were like, hey, you've had experience dealing with murder investigations before and that, you know, why don't you give us some advice? And she was just like, just, you know, seriously, you know, they were both blues and they both met with Moraine and, or they both had contact with Moraine and Randall Thor, start looking there. You know, it seemed like one of those things that she didn't really, I didn't take it as a conscious, you need to go and look at the Ashaman, but I think she just kind of threw out the first connection to the or that both sisters had to anything that was in common, and then said, follow the connections. You know, just as a kind of, you know, this is a puzzle, put it together for your own self.
Well, I have to say that that scene to me probably has more significance than it should. And to me, in my fevered imagination, that ramped up Naonin a thousandfold in my, this one might be a dark friend list. Because two things, she tried to send them off against Randall Thor and the Ashaman, and she knew a lot of stuff about the White Tower, and she knew some things that I think maybe she just shouldn't have known unless she was a dark friend and in contact with other higher-up dark friends. You know, it just made me suspicious of her absolutely to the max. I think she's playing both sides against the middle, and I think she's a dark friend.
We need to start a list. Virginia's list of who's a dark friend now.
Exactly. I have a little list. They'll never be missed.
Anathon Shadar Quarterly.
Oh, I like it. We need to do a new newsletter. We need to do, like, you know, Perez Hilton, and who's the actual, what's the dish on the dark friends now? Who was seen partying with who?
That's not a bad idea.
One of the things that also kind of picked out in my mind, and it's probably nothing that I have just kind of expanded into seeing something. I'm often really, really suspicious when they introduce a character with a name and they seem to give a chunk of information or really characterize that person, and then that person disappears. I mentioned it in the last podcast with the leader of the Dragonsworn that was being led by Rodel Itrald. And this chapter had one too. Bandon's warder, Tervail. It just seemed to me that they characterized him, and they made him, you know, they really went to Bandon thinking about, well, he doesn't know the place that we're going to, so he hops through, and, you know, how diligent he is in protecting her and everything. And then she just kind of says, oh, go into the city and find an inn until we're done here. You know, when he's displaying all the warderly characteristics of, you need to kill Elida, send me in alone, I can get, you know, and there's so many warders in the White Tower, you know, I can get into her and have a knife in her heart before anybody could react. And, you know, all of his mannerisms are kind of laid out there, and to me, it just screamed, dead, he's gonna die.
Red shirt.
Exactly, and it just seemed like, why did we get, you know, the two or three paragraphs that characterized, you know, how diligent he was in his duties and what kind of man he was if she was just going to dismiss him to an inn and go up to the White Tower? I mean, maybe he'll show up in, you know, the next book or so and play some important role, but I still have this dread feeling that we're going to see him bite it for no apparent reason.
You do realize that RJ spent more time characterizing Tervail, Bannon's warder, than he did in the actual killing off of Aurum, who we had to suffer through his mournful behaviors for book after book after book. Where's the justice?
You're just not going to get over him killing Aurum in a sentence and a half.
No, not after we had to put up with him for that long. No, uh-uh. That tinker drove me crazy. Or I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of words. That character probably had more words than a lot of books, as Brandon said, you know, have 120,000 words or something like that. I'll bet we were close to that with Aurum. I'm going to go through and count them one of these days when I have nothing better to do in my life. I'll bet you we had 50,000 or 60,000 words on Aurum alone. And if you counted in all the times that Perrin thought about Aurum, yeah, lots of words.
I'm sorry, I didn't like that guy.
Well, apparently that's the way RJ thought about him, too, because he said, okay, you're dead. It's sort of the length of the length of the thing.
I know, I feel his pain. I did not like that guy.
I don't know who could like him. Even Perrin couldn't like him.
Yeah, I mean, he did kind of seem to be like the sleazeball amongst the tinkers. And then, you know, he shows up in the Two Rivers, and, you know, he's just had, you know, his parents have just been cut down, and we're like, oh great, now the tinker's going to go pick up, and then, you know, suddenly he's like becoming the sword version of an Aiel all over again, and it was just one of those things that he's dedicated, and the further you see with him, or the further points of view in which you see him, he's just getting crazier and crazier, and by the time Massima shows up, you know, it's just like, okay, we can see that this is going no place good. And then it was just kind of a sudden turnaround that, you know, they're charging through the battle and RM turns on Perrin, and you're like, yes, Perrin's going to have to kill him, and it's going to be some sort of cathartic event for Perrin, even if he doesn't realize it immediately. And then RM's putting up a decent fight, and he gets shot with arrows.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty funny. It isn't funny. It's probably sad, but, you know, it is kind of amazing the way that whole thing went. Like I said to Brandon when we were talking to him, and I think at some point in time, RJ just realized that he had way too many characters to wrap up in only one more book and had to just start killing them off with a little bit more frequency. Because as we know, he really didn't kill off a lot of characters. And one of the ones that he did kill off early on, if I may digress even a little farther, was Herod Fell. I really liked him, and he bought it right away. And I could have lived with him around for a while, not Aram. Anyway.
Yeah, but he made Herod too knowledgeable, particularly in philosophy. And the more I think about that, philosophy was Ishmael's major thing before he went over to the Dark One. And you know, I'm not wondering, because Moradin was directing the actions of at least the one golem that we've seen, if maybe there was a little bit of jealousy, as well as, well, this Fel could figure out too much stuff about the prophecies and could help the Dragon Reborn too much. That, you know, maybe there was a little bit of jealousy in there too, and it's like, hey, someone's encroaching on my turf, go kill him.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all, actually. And it's really funny, because going back to Bayonin, I feel like she's going to be somehow significant in the next book. I guess we'll find out in a month or so. But, you know, she always is sort of a throwaway character. You know, she was just one of the group of the, you know, Saladar Aes Sedai that were sort of in charge. You know, she and Morbrin and a few others haven't really distinguished themselves in too many ways. You know, Carlinia has basically only distinguished herself by being as annoying as humanly possible. Although then she did come up with the brilliant assessment that it just wasn't possible to, you know, gentle Loghain again without serious repercussions. So I forgive her for a lot for that. But Bayonin has now distinguished herself and moved herself up into the limelight to the point where I'm wondering what other role she's going to play. And if she is, in fact, a Black Aja, then we may find that she's really well-placed between the two camps. I mean, Elida thinks that she's loyal to her. Egwene now thinks that she's got her loyalty back because of the oath. So I see some possibilities for some interaction there.
Yeah, I definitely think that she's going to end up being fairly prominent in the storyline. I definitely think she seems like one of those characters who is designed to be a plot vehicle, while not being one of the major upfront and, you know, constantly there characters. She really does seem... It seems odd to say she really seems like a vehicle, but that's where my mind was going with that concept.
No, and I How totally else do agree I with you. I think, remember, as you called some of the other characters like Bael Doman and so forth, the glue characters that, you know, allow things to happen and progress between the various different storylines, which do tend to get widely separated. I think she's the flip side of that coin. I think she's a chaos character. She's an agent of chaos in a lot of ways, and I think that she's an ungluer, if you will, and that she'll probably have some significant role to play in the dispute between the White Tower and Egwene's faction. She's a chaos magnet. And I also wonder, if she is a Dark Friend, which Forsaken or Senior Dark Friend might be running her, and I think my pick would be Missana for that. Although Moradin did claim to have agents in both camps, although we don't know who they are, but maybe she's a Moradin agent.
She could be one of the ones who doesn't realize that she is.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. Thank you. That's right. They play these people like chess pieces, and sometimes even the people that are key players don't even know that they're being played. And to be honest, Bannon seems just kind of like Elida. She seems just arrogant and self-confident enough to be used without realizing that she's being used. And she's already shown that she can turn her coat any number of times. I mean, she's despicable, actually, is what she is.
It's odd because do we ever really, truly get the reasons that she's doing what she's doing? I mean, this point of view was, you know, kind of startlingly lacking in those particular, you know, we don't really get that she's going to the White Tower until she goes there. And, you know, we know that she's a mole that was sent in, but at the same time, it seems like we never really get a solid reasons as to, you know, well, does she believe this is right? Or, you know, why is she doing any of what she's doing?
Well, all the other Aes Sedai have certainly got her pegged, at least in their minds, Elida and Lyanna and everyone about which anybody has spoken about Bannon has said that her main driving force is ambition. She wants to better herself. She's ambitious. She's ambitious enough for three. You know, they've all said comments like that about her. And that's one thing that we don't see from her point of view, that she's ambitious like that. But at least one person mentioned that if she didn't get her due, they could see her, you know, changing sides or doing something else. So at least others perceive her as being ambitious certainly beyond the bounds of normal integrity, if nothing else. And how unlike an Aes Sedai to give away that much to all of her sisters. Usually they play it a little closer to the chest than that. I mean, Alviarin was certainly noted for being ambitious too, but I don't think that was the first thing that everybody said about her. So I guess that gets us through the end of Chapter 2, The Dark One's Touch, and we'll continue on with this in the next episode and hopefully get through a little bit more than two chapters, because at this rate we're not going to get done before the Gathering Storm comes out, and I know we're going to want to be talking about that immediately.
Well, maybe not immediately. Give me some time to read.
You know how fast I'm going to go through that thing, and then I'll be on the second reread before I have it 2 days, I'll bet you. And listening to the audiobook in the car the instant I get it. I mean, it's going to be the Gathering Storm absorption period nonstop all the time, 24/7 until I have it done. I won't be able to rest. I know it.
Well, at least you will have a very excellent copy from which to read.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. Not until November, anyway. I don't get the actual signed copy until after the book tour is over. Well, but yay! I was so excited. I couldn't believe I actually won something.
Well, that's going to just about do it for our recap of the first two chapters, at least, of Knife of Dreams. We really tried to get through as much as we could, and we only got through chapters 1 and 2, but next week we'll do better, I promise.
Absolutely. We're really going to make a concerted effort to get it a little more together and rip through them a little faster this next time, because we want to get this all done before the Gathering Storm arrives.
Or, hey, you know, if you don't want us to speed it up, just tell us. You know, everybody knows our email address. It's podcastdragonmont.com.
Yes, and bearing that in mind, there are a number of ways you can get a hold of us if you wish to give us any sort of feedback. We listen to and read everything that comes across or comes our way. Of course, you can always leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And as Jason mentioned, you can email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. You can also leave us comments at the end of each podcast on the podcast page at dragonmount.com, and there is also a podcast forum at dragonmount.com.
We also have our MySpace page, which is www.myspace.com/fourthage, and you can follow us both through our Facebook group and on Twitter.
Yes, we have a Fourth Age podcast page on Facebook. You can just be a fan of the page. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, that's easily done. If you want to become a personal friend or something like that, just mention that you're with the podcast and, you know, we'll make you a friend, and then you can actually chat with us if we happen to be online. Now that Facebook has a new chat feature, we can give that a try.
Sometimes we'll notice in our comment sections when we've developed a number of differing opinions about things that we have said. I know in the most recent posted episode, in episode 55, The Geopolitical Ramifications, there was some dissension over what we meant when we had said that Perrin will turn over the collected area of Manethrin to the Seanchan. There was probably a slight miscommunication there, which resulted in a retractment being placed in the comment section. Any sort of feedback is always, always great to hear. And we encourage everyone, if you've got a crazy theory, send it in to us. You know, if you see where we've made a mistake, by all means, point it out. We are fans, but we are by no means infallible in any way, shape, or form.
That's absolutely right. We're just fans like you guys, and we're just sitting down talking about this, you know, hopefully the way all of us would together as friends if we were together and able to just sit down around a cup of calf and, you know, talk about our favorite fantasy series, the calf or cough.
I understood exactly what you meant, regardless of how it's pronounced. With that, I will say good evening to everyone, and I definitely look forward to spending a whole lot more time and research involved with spending time with both Andrew and Virginia.
Well, we're glad to have you back, Jason, and, you know, we'll try to sit around together, you know, like the Forsaken at their little tea parties and talk about the things that we love the most. In our case, it's not, you know, how to grab more power and glory, but how to try and figure out where this series is going. So with that, this is Virginia saying, may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian Intalan Shima, Kai Shite.
Okay, so
do you know what I always wondered about Randland?
Go ahead, sorry, what?
They managed to invent the train, but nobody has thought to make a bicycle.
Well, and they didn't make tracks for the bloody train either. Yeah, you would think that a bicycle would be pretty obvious, wouldn't you? I mean, they even at the menagerie, they had this guy rolling on the big egg-shaped thing. I thought, well, you know, that's a really short step from like that to a unicycle. Working on that. We need bicycles. Although the roads are pretty much unpaved, so that might be a really, really rough ride.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the original bicycles had to be ridden on country roads, because not all of them existed in Renaissance Italy.
It's true. Okay, well, bicycles aside,